My dear friend Sharon up for step 12. Thank you.
For just a wonderful weekend, and everybody's been so great. We've been given so many gifts this weekend, and I think the gift has already been given and packaged and the ribbons around it, and my job is just to hold my little finger on the first tie of the ribbon so God can make the bow. So I feel very humbled and honored and happy to be here and putting my finger on the ribbon so the bow can be made. Anyway, did anybody peek? They said don't, and I want to, but if they'd say just open it up and don't worry about it, it's a surprise, but you know, pretend like you didn't, then everybody go, oh, no, I want a surprise. Little condom that we got here. Anyway, it's just been so wonderful, and the 12 step is absolutely one of my absolute favorites. Sandy talked about staying on course, and the way I like to think of staying on course to get to having some sort of awakening is there's this hallway that I go down, and much of the time, and when I'm new, I'm banging off both sides of the hallway, like just hard, because I'm so rebellious and I'm trying to re-groove a record. I don't know if you've ever tried to re-groove a record, but you know, most of you guys don't know what vinyl is anymore. Sorry, but you know, if it's got that skip on it, and every time you play that, just you know, it's Janis singing, and it skips right in Peace of My Heart. You know, don't do that. So you got to just hold your finger on the needle ever so perfectly, so it starts to make a new groove over that skip, and it's kind of painful, and it takes some pressure, but eventually the needle will go through that groove and give you some music. And that's kind of the way I learned how to stay on course in Alcoholics Anonymous. Is kind of, somebody had to put their finger on me and just kind of gently re-groove through that hard vinyl, make a new trail for the needle to follow. And I bounce off this side of the wall, just bruise the heck out of myself. And then, you know, then I kind of stand course in the middle for a little bit, and then I go bounce off the other side of the hallway and bruise myself and batter myself and get bloody with the defects and the rebellion and the self-centeredness. And then eventually, as my sponsor says, watch for the road, watch for the path as you travel in through the middle to beat yourself up on the other side. So somewhere, oh, awareness, oh, there's the path. Okay, here I go, I'm going to beat myself up on the other side and knock me out. So that's kind of how I learned, is just how to, maybe I'll kind of feel the hallway come, you know, just, and I don't have to just graze it a little and then come back in the groove. And then I graze the other side and come back in the groove. I don't have to beat myself up so much more to get in the middle of the road. And there's a big path between both sides of the wall. Big path. I like to stay smack in the center because that's where Santa Claus is. My son had a little toy when he was little, and you would push it really fast, and it was a Christmas tree, and it would, if you got the speed right, it would open up, and inside was Santa. And it's like, that's where I want to be, right in the middle of this thing in Santa's lap, you know, telling him what I want, you know, but safe and secure in the middle of this thing. So the 12th step is always, I mean, by the time I got to the 12th step, Sandy talked a lot about grace. You know, we've laughed our way through this weekend. We've opened our hearts up through this weekend. We've made friends through this weekend. We've taken a hard look at some things through this weekend. And Sandy opened up the word grace, and as everybody else did too. Any kind of opening up that happened this weekend is a piece of grace, because the bricks have been talked about, and the walls have been rebuilt and torn down and rebuilt and torn down, and I want those spiritual muscles so that when I reach for that heavy piece of cinder block, you know, it's like I pick it up and it just, I don't know if I want to put it in my life again. You know, it took so much to have those spiritual muscles to take it out of there. And how did I get to the point of being able to take those cinder blocks out of my life that just make it so hard? What are the bricks between me and that bottle of Jose Cuervo Gold? What are they? It's a lot of working with others. It's a lot of God. It's a lot of staying in the middle of the road. It's a lot of showing up when I don't know I have anything to give. It's a lot of commitments. It's a lot of getting on my knees. It's a lot of answering the phone late at night. It's a lot of getting in the car and driving to Oildale. It's a lot of that kind of stuff that keep me flexible and keep me a seeker. I am a seeker. I was a little girl in Iowa sitting in the soybean field seeking the mothership. There was something inside of me long before I took a drink that was a seeker. And I'm a more drinker. I'm a tequila drinker. I'm a Jack Daniels drinker. I like Harleys. I like dark, rowdy bars. I like loud jukeboxes. I like moving in the middle of the night to Florida. I like the lights of the carnival. You know, I like my organic patch that I grooved and grow out in the middle of Wisconsin on great seed. I like laying there all day long and eating it. I'm just kind of that kind of a more gal. You know, if it's good, let's do more. And in sobriety, I'm not disappointed. I'm not disappointed because that piece of grace that got me at 31 days when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I don't stay sober. I'm at Fort Walton Beach Officers Club. I've got 14 shots of tequila lined up. It's the 4th of July. I am the only female in there. I'm being taken care of. But I've got to go into the bathroom, lock the door, and take my bottle out of my bag and hit on it because I don't get enough. I don't get enough. There is not a satiation point with me anymore where I have enough. I'm seeking, I'm looking, I'm running, I'm intense. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, I got to see the gift of walking into a meeting on August 20th, 1975, when I woke up a drinker and I went to bed a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Not looking for it, not wondering about it, not knowing I'm an alcoholic, but it was my day. I was surrendered by alcohol. I was at that point where there was no friendly direction, as my sponsor says, and I picked up the phone to call my mother with my jaw broken in three places and my nose and a victim of violent crime and sucking on cheap wine through the wires on the mouth where the tooth had been kicked out. And I'm a drinker. And I called my mom because the guy that was letting me stay there said I'd have to leave. I was depressing him. And my mom said, no, Sharon, go to the Salvation Army. And that was a piece of grace. Because if she would have sent $20 by seconds and inches, you'd have another speaker. And the pieces of grace that led me to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous where somebody raised my hand, where they looked at me and went, look at her. She looks surrendered. Maybe she'll make it. They were glad. They didn't spend a lot of time with me. They just kind of shuffled me around. And at 31 days of sobriety, I'm going to these meetings because they're picking me up. They say, don't drink and use in between. We'll pick you up. I couldn't say anything for 3 months because I was wired shut. So and I was tired. I was blessedly tired. I think of August 21st, maybe I would have had a plan. But on August 20th, I had no plan. And God came into my life in a moment of grace with a lot of little bread crumbs leading me to my solution for my disease of alcoholism that I didn't even know I had, and that's a precious gift. That's an amazing day, and we've each one had that day. And 31 days, I'm raising my hand because I got to raise my hand to stay here. That's what someone told me. You know, like I said, I can't talk. I have to, just information's coming my way all the time. People felt they could talk to me because I couldn't talk back, and my mind was racing like, you guys talk so much about yourselves. Nobody asked me about me. I had the newspaper clipping in my pocket, ready to go. Unemployed bartender from New Orleans was beaten up in Palm Springs. I'm ready to pull it out and show you. Nobody asked. They just, she looks tired. Now, your turn to take her to the coffee shop tonight. But at 31 days, my hand, I went, and there was a little feeling of warmth and light, and I guess it was grace. And I went, I don't stay sober 31 days. For just a moment, the power gave me that wind of a kiss. And that did something different inside me that I didn't realize had done something. It had opened up a little bit of a channel, just a little bit of a innocent channel. And over the years, those moments started to come more and more. And I didn't look at them like moments of grace. I guess they were moments of awareness. They came at me in many different ways. They came at me in ways of when my son was born. I was thinking about the word awake, and I used to love to watch him wake up. When they're that innocent and they're that little. And I used to love to watch him wake up because he would do it slowly. More, you know, smile on his face, and eyes not even open yet. And he would open them slowly and just kind of maybe be aware of his surroundings, which were comfortable and safe and warm. And then he would see me and he would break into the biggest smile. And I think that's how we bring ourselves to God. Just slowly and with the biggest smile. I'm so happy to know that the joy of living, that's what we're here for, is to bring that joy of living into every single area of our life, to bring that light. And I was thinking about Don Pritz. I used to tell a story. Oh, I love this story. About the little boy, much like Clint's story, the little boy who knew there was another one coming, you know? And he had all the attention until the other one was coming. And he kept saying to his mom, you know, here it is in the belly, and it's a baby's going to come, and you're going to, you know, have a new little sister. And he was all excited about it. He could feel her moving and all that. But when the little girl came home from the hospital, he didn't get any more attention. But he kept saying to mom, Mom, I got to spend some time with her. And, you know, they were looking at him acting out a little bit and worried about him being alone with her, but he kept wanting to spend some alone time with his little baby sister. So they just kind of kept him away, didn't think much about it. And as she gets older and, you know, a little more stable, they didn't want to let him in the room alone with her. And one morning, the mother got up early and he was in there. And so she, for a minute, she thought, okay, well, you know, is he thumping her on the head? And she listened at the door, and she heard the little boy say to his little sister, quick, tell me about God. I'm starting to forget. And it was like, that's what it is when I work with others. Tell me about God. Show me about God. I don't want to forget. And so this joy, no matter what, is finds its way into my life by my awareness, by my opening of my eyes, by my opening of my heart. How do I get that heart open? At 7 years of sobriety, I remember standing at the podium to take my birthday cake, and I had this feeling of being shot through with love. I burst into so much of a smile. And that was one of the first little experiences I got to see of somebody else experiencing the joy of living. Now, there's all kinds of ways to get to some sort of state of consciousness, of God consciousness, and not self-consciousness. And one of the ways I know that it was done with me is they just kept me entertained long enough before the program started to work. And that's kind of my job with new people sometimes, is just to keep them in the room. Don't drink, as Sandy said, and keep them entertained long enough for the program to start working. And peer pressure. The peer pressure is good. In our group, there's a lot of peer pressure. There's a girl that has 8 days less than me that got more attention when she came into the program because I couldn't talk, I wasn't fun to hang around with, I couldn't eat. And Pat came in 8 days after me and sobbed because her husband was sick. And all the old-timers that I desperately wanted them to pat me on the head went over to Pat and gave her tons of attention. And Pat was going through the steps so quickly and so perfectly, and always had those old-timers around her, and she was always crying. I thought, you're so weak, you know? I wasn't going to shed a tear. I don't think if my jaw was... I could have probably kept my jaw shut if it wasn't wired, but so much anger was in me. But Pat had done all her steps, and I didn't realize her husband was dying of cancer, and it was very important. But this peer pressure of, she'd done all the steps. She's ahead of me. She's 8 days less than me. And somebody wasn't, I asked this lady named Gail. I said, I can't start my inventory. She said, I'm sick of you talking about it. You pick up that 1,000-pound pencil and you go home and you start writing, and I'm sick of you talking about it. You've talked to all of us about it for a month or two. I just thought, screw you, I'm going to go drink at you. And I think I was actually rounding the corner to go to the liquor store, and I had a thought. I'll have less time than Pat. So peer pressure can work, you know, it really can work. And the joy of it is we still celebrate Pat and I our birthdays every August. I still have those 8 days on her. And I tell her that it's quantity, not quality. So but passing all of this on to the alcoholic who still suffers is nobody can do it but us. And it goes through a whole long thing in the book about how to do it right and what to do right. And I remember one of my very first 12-step calls. I got sober in 75. We were really having 12-step calls then. They were really calling to come to Alcoholics Anonymous. My last 12-step call was an insomniac who, unfortunately, Central Office gave them my home number. So that was interesting when I realized she was not an alcoholic and insomniac. But, you know, those real 12-step calls, I'd love to see them coming back. I actually smelled a little alcohol in a meeting a week ago. Somebody knew, and my baby was like, oh, there's someone here drinking. I said, well, it's AA, honey, let's go find them. Let's go see if we can talk to them. Had never even smelled someone drinking in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's how shined up we get sometimes. So I went to have this conversation with this new lady that called, and she was at a very seedy motel. I lived in Inglewood when I was new. So I got all the seedy motels, and I'm a B. They used to use a Rolodex, and they would get to me first. And so I would go find this seedy motel over by the airport, and I drug this lady out, and her friend is passed out, her lover is passed out, and drug her out to a meeting, and she had a black eye, and she was drunk and belligerent, and I brought her to Ohio Street. And I had no idea what I was doing. And I remember sitting by Clint. Clint sat on the other side because he tried to calm her down for me. And I didn't know what to do with her. I was fairly new, but I got the help I needed to have her have a meeting. I didn't know I could, you know, shush her or whatever. I just thought, I'm doing God's work, I better do it right. And so the old timers in the room took over for me, and I gave it to her that night. I think she was in a blackout, really, but I gave her my best and gave her the book and gave her the literature and laid her down on the bed to go to sleep, and he still passed out, and I never heard from her again. I was brokenhearted. But it was an experience I did not want to miss. It was an experience of going to those seedy motels by a seedy airport, and that's what I did, you know, with the carnival and all my travels on the road, and, you know, freedom's just another word and out of my way. I mean, that's what I was. I was that girl with the black eye. I was that lady that was smelling and sick and had no hope. And so it renewed my spirit. It awakened my heart. And the book also talks about maybe it's time sometimes when you have to move on and you've helped somebody so much that they're not getting it. They, you know, they don't want it. And a friend of mine, my very first friend named Sandy, we were very close and new together and going through things about the same time. You know, a buddy is great to have. And Sandy got engaged, and then he broke it off, and she went out. And 6 months later, she called me, and I said, oh, God, I've been worried about you. Come over. Come sleep on my couch. Let's go to a meeting. Okay. I'm going to get a job again. Things are going to get good. And she stayed for a couple of weeks, and then I came home one night, and she's gone. And I heard from her maybe a year and a half later, and she was in a recovery home. So I went down and got her and brought her in the meeting. And things are going to be different. I'm going to get a job, and men aren't my higher power anymore, and life is good, and I'm in this recovery home, and they're giving me a chance. And I said, great. You know, I picked her up for a couple of days, and then she was gone. And I didn't hear from her for years. Years. And I heard from her from a payphone. And so I said, where are you? She told me where she was. I said, good, let me come get you. Come sleep on my couch. We'll get it going. Make some meetings. She said, no, Sharon, I just want some money. I said, Sandy, come on. You know where it is. You know where the gift is. You know where to come for it. You know what your problem is. It's alcoholism. Of course your head's going to be loud right now. Let's air it out and dry it up and bring you back in. And I need some money. I said, Sandy, I can't help you with that. I can't help you with that. She was reduced to needing some money and broke my heart. I had to say no, broke my heart. I said, I've had the same phone number for, I think, 30 years. So people still find me, which is a blessing. So I haven't heard she's gone yet, so maybe she'll surface. If they're breathing, we still have hope. So I had to let go. That one was hard. But the joy of practicing these principles, what are these principles? Well, things like honesty, tolerance, patience, love, courage, forgiveness, perseverance, trust, surrender, acceptance, gratitude. I'm so grateful for these enduring principles that we live, because I can't live any other way comfortably. I wish I could sometimes. I think, how do they get away with that? And somebody one day said to me fairly recently, if you knew how they get away with it, Sharon, you could do it. Don't spend too much time trying to figure it out. Oh, okay, got it. Don't even worry about it. Just bless them and move on. And that made a lot of sense to me. But, the right action is the key to good living. And taking the right action in my life, like making amends to my father. I had made amends, and things started to get very, very good. And I'll tell you, when the awareness came in and my defects of character were in my face with a family visit. Family's been talked about. We have the family of blood and then the family of understanding, and you're my family of understanding. And the family of blood, no alcoholics in there, just me. And, the Mensa sister and the Nurse Sally, who was two, got a nurse kit for Christmas, wanted to be a nurse and lived to Alaska, and that's what she's still doing. She knew at two what her path was. And my brother, who carried the family name, and then the alcoholic. Then there was me, and I was always a source of entertainment. They like my friends more now. It's, in fact, they've adopted many of my friends, my sober friends. But I went home for my sister's wedding, and I had been through the steps. I had gone through the process of the amends with my family, especially with my father, who said, I always wanted you to be happy, and took a long time to mend that road. I broke his heart. I shared and shared alike. He saw a lot of what I was sharing, and it wasn't pretty, and I drug it home and shook it in his face just to hurt that man with the big shoulders who should have been able to fix me. And he couldn't. And I'd let him close, and I'd push him back. And I'd let him close with my pain. He'd have a solution, and I'd push him back. I brought the priest down to try to help me in college. We got drunk. The priest and I got drunk right in front of my father, who became speechless. But I'm on a plane, and I'm going home. And it's just me coming down to my sister's wedding in Iowa in the summer, and they all were in the van to pick me up, the minivan. They were all in the minivan to pick me up, and I hadn't had my child yet, so it was before 1984, so I think I was in the beginning of my financial amends with my father. It was right in that spot. I'm 7-8 years sober, and they picked me up at the airport, and I'm so happy to see everybody, and I'm in the minivan, and we lived way out in the country, 3 miles outside of Mount Vernon, Iowa, and just beautiful place that I was ashamed to be of for years, to be from. I was from Wisconsin because they had cheese. It felt more dignified when I was out in the world with my Midwest accent. I couldn't fool them, but Iowa had pigs and corn, and that's how I felt. So I didn't. Wisconsin had cheese. It was more dignified. And so I was never even the person from where I was born. I was a lie much of the time. And we're driving down this beautiful country road off of Highway 1 to get by the Cedar River where my parents lived. And all of a sudden, the Mensa's in the front seat talking to my dad about high finance. My sister, who's getting married, is in the back seat talking with my mom about plans. The brother-in-law, who I just met, is talking to my brother about guy things. And I'm sitting in the middle being ignored. This middle child thing came up again from the roots, from the depth of my taproot. Found its way up, found its way into my gut, found its way past my heart, found its way into my head, found its way into my resentments, found its way into my justifications, and I started sobbing. I started having this cathartic sobbing in the middle of this beautiful country road with my family all around me. And my dad stops the van and turns around and looks at me and goes, "Are you okay?" And this is the moment I've waited for my whole life. This is my platform from which I'm going to tell every one of them why my life is so screwed up, and that was screwed up, and the victim I am, and it's your fault. So get ready. I am opening the floodgates. But what happened was a little bit of awareness snuck in there. A little bit of God said, "Get out of the van." And I heard it, and I got out of the van, and I said, "I just need some air." You know, I am cathartic. This is like big. This is that uncontrollable sobbing from your toes. And I'm standing outside the van looking at the corn. And I'm trying. A few pigs in there over there, smell them. Well, they don't see them. I smell them. They're there, pigs and corn. And I had this moment of grace, which is shut up, don't say anything, breathe. So I looked at the cornfield and I started to breathe. And I thought, you know, maybe restraint here is the best way to go. It's not my weekend, it's my sister's wedding. And that got through to me. So that I looked at that cornfield, and Casey talks about this, and I love it that he's not from Iowa, but he gets it. He gets me. There's a whole plan to tilling that soil. There's a whole bunch of people have to put stuff in it. Things have to be worked. Things have to be thought out. You can't just rework the soil year after year after year and get a bumper crop. You have to sometimes plow it under, sometimes leave it alone, sometimes plant something else that you don't like as much. But the job is to pay attention to the soil. And this beautiful cornfield was there, and you can really watch it grow in the summer. You can watch it grow. If you look hard enough at it, it just shot up a little more. And there's life over the top of a cornfield. There's birds, and there's those little tiny bugs, and there's some light that reflects from the sun. It just soaks it up, the sun. It just pulls it in, and there's a light, there's an aura about a cornfield. And I just, for a moment, my eyes opened up, and I had the awareness of perfect, thought-out, cared-for, loved life. And then as I turned to get in back in the van, I calmed down. I saw the rows all laid out, just for a second. It's all green and pretty and wavy, but just for a second, I saw that it had been laid out in rows. And there's a plan. There's a big plan to this, and you're in it. Who makes you think you're not in it? Take the victim cloak off. It's so heavy. I felt the heaviness of it. And I was able to leave a lot of that there, right off of Highway 1 in that cornfield that I like to drive by when I go home. Wave at my victim cloak on the scarecrow over in the corner. You wear it. You need it. Scare those crows away.